Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and we hope everybody had a very happy Easter. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Normally, our business roundtable joins us every Sunday, but because of the Easter holiday, we have slipped it to Easter Monday. COVID cases in the United States are on the rise as Americans are behaving as if the pandemic was over. The European Union remains flailing as COVID cases soar and vaccine rollouts drag out as President Biden announced a $2.2 trillion infrastructure plan, the first of a two-part $4 trillion national investment effort that would be paid through higher taxes on corporations, as well as those earning more than $400,000 a year. Markets have been surging on positive jobs numbers in the United States and anticipated industrial demand for everything from air travel to computer chips. Joining us, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in sunny Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, happy Easter Monday to all of you, and thanks very much for joining us again.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. Happy Easter to you.
Happy day after Easter, Vago. Great to be here.
Thanks very much again. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and General Motors Defense is joining us as our new sponsor for our technology coverage. Ron, big investment package, obviously, last week, coming on what was maybe a slightly shorter day. Folks took off for Good Friday. A lot of folks did. Includes the infrastructure package, does include tech investment that goes beyond roads and rail. There's artificial intelligence, quantum, chip manufacturing, something which we've talked about on this program, which is a limiting industrial factor. And the market appears to have overcome some of those inflation fears, although yields still ticked up last week. How are markets reacting, and how are defense and aerospace shares faring in all of this?
Yeah, so if you look at the market, yields kicked up a little bit, but seems like yields are settling in around this, at least on the 10-year, 1.7, 1.8%. Probably, the next mental barrier, if you will, hurdle out there is 2%. So we'll see what happens there. Internally, our economists are calling for the 10-year to get to about 2.5%, maybe by the end of the year. So let's see if they're right. And then when you look at the broader market, the Dow and the S&P are either at or near all-time highs. And that's part of several factors, right? We've seen some rotation into what's, quote unquote, called value, more cyclical names. So we've seen some money flowing kind of out of tech into the world that we're more familiar with. If you look at the performance of aerospace and defense, both sides of the group have actually been faring quite well. So, if you look at the market just today, the market is up and all of A&D is up. We're seeing, the big defense names outperforming the S&P today, as well as some of the commercial names. So we're seeing, an equitable distribution of the loftiness in the market being, playing through both sides of the group. Just to remind folks, if you look at the defense stocks in the latter half of last year, particularly the last quarter of the year, their relative multiple to the market really sold off. And if you look at the defense relative to the market, at one point it was almost trading at half the market multiple. And those are the kind of multiples that we saw, honestly, back when the Berlin Wall fell down. So be it that, we're probably not in for that right now. It's not surprising you're starting to see defense kind of get a multiple that's maybe a little more balanced with where the market is. So I'll leave it there.
Are folks worried about, right? I mean, infrastructure, government investment on what are sort of strategic discriminators, on the one hand, is, has a tendency of buoying markets, whereas on the other hand, taxes or talk about higher taxes. Obviously, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, is going to launch a global minimum tax initiative so that governments across the world at least impose some minimum taxes. I know, Sash, I mean, this is an issue in Europe where Ireland has been able to play sort of the tax limbo. Hey, why don't we host your headquarters? What I was interested in some of the coverage was how realistic some of it was that, well, you know, a lot of companies didn't pay tax or have actually been getting refunds, including some very big blue chip names, whether it's Nike or FedEx, right? I mean, we're actually getting government money as opposed to paying taxes or getting, you know, certainly on the positive side of that ledger. And there would be only natural that you know, taxes may increase in the future. How is that news being received by markets kind of overall, or the market overall?
Yeah, so I think the concept of a change in the tax code when, you know, you had the change in administration, the market, my sense is, absorbed it then, right? I mean, I don't think any market players thought the tax code was going to stay the same with the change in administration. And I think there was a broad expectation that you would see the, you know, the corporate tax rate go back up, as well as, you know, taxes for individuals. So, you know, none of what's happening now is a surprise to the market. The market, my sense is, and just to be clear, this is Ron's opinion, not Bank of America. Right. I'm not a strategist or the bank economist, but, you know, my sense is, like the market typically does, it tries to absorb this stuff before it happens. And then there's always a little bit of pause, right? Because ultimately, what does the change in the tax code ultimately look like? Will they really be able to push through a global minimum tax or not? How's that all going to play out? I mean, we'll have to see. But there's no surprises going on here, right? And this was, I think, you know, one of the expected things that would change with the change in administration.
Sash, let me bring you into the conversation, right? I mean, the pandemic is getting worse in Europe. We've been talking about air travel booming in the United States. In fact, I mean, one of the concerns now is whether airlines can surge quickly enough to pick up the North American demand. I know that long haul still remains, you know, endangered. And obviously, Europe's still locked down in part because of just the staggering slowness of the vaccine rollout. What are your expectations about demand side in the United States and what that means for the makers at this point, right? For Boeing, for Airbus, and obviously, right, I mean, all the other guys who are in this, including Embraer.
At the global level, there's a ton of unused and underused aircraft out there. Clearly, there is a short-term, very, very interesting squeeze going on in the US, which is actually largely about bringing existing fleets back to safe operation. And this is something we've talked about in the last couple of months, as evenly and as well as possible. But looking at how fast the US domestic market has recovered. Remember, it's the US domestic market. The international market is dead, and if anywhere else you look in the world, long haul international is dreadful. In Europe, domestic is even worse. China has recovered and is sort of leveling out again. But this recovery at this stage is astonishingly uneven. And the US domestic market is currently the poster child. It would, you know, there will clearly be some airlines who feel that now is the time to, if they have the balance sheet, to try to put in either orders to get some really low cost capacity, or indeed, which is the case with the vast majority of the airlines who are customers for the Boeing 737 MAX, using the compensation payment that they're getting from Boeing to top up with more MAXes, which, you know, will keep them going certainly for the next 5-6 years or so. But we've been doing a bit of work on Airbus's orders, and Airbus's, and they should be announcing their orders and deliveries for March in the next couple of days this week. Their orders and deliveries in January and February were incredibly low. January is always a dreadful month, absolutely, because everybody is still, you know, sorting themselves out after overproducing in December. But February production didn't pick up very much. And I mean, a couple of conclusions come to my mind. One is that I think this is going to be the year in which, just in terms of orders, and I mean, orders are slightly stage managed anyway, but in terms of orders, Boeing, I think, has got every probability of beating Airbus in 2021 because they've got all of these MAX compensation orders coming through. Should we care? Perhaps not very much. But in terms of deliveries, Airbus, I think, will out-deliver Boeing, definitely, because the 737 MAX return to service is going so slowly. But objectively, year on year, Airbus probably won't show any year on year growth until May, June would be the time at which they should start to show a little bit of a recovery because Q2 was so bad. But I still think that Q1 is going to have been a dreadful quarter. And they're going to carry a lot of working capital as they go through the year and try to claw it all back in November, December, which is what they normally do. But are we going to see airlines going back to the good old days, bad old days of ordering 600, 800 aircraft a year? Really unlikely. 2021 is not that year. And interestingly, Guillaume Faury, the CEO of Airbus, was on a webinar sponsored by Eurocontrol, and he said global domestic short-haul traffic probably only get back to 2019 levels in 2023. And when he was asked about long-haul, he said, we really don't know, which is refreshingly honest of him.
Richard, you are the bull in our midst in terms of spring back. What did you make of Sasha's analysis, including the provocative notion that Boeing could beat Airbus on these numbers and Guillaume's point more broadly about when the market's going to be snapping back, especially for on the wide body side of things?
Yeah, there's it's not exactly my favorite uniformly flawless perfect time to be a bull right now, to be fair.
A perfect time? You're leading the pack, right? You're on the forward edge, the bleeding edge of it.
It's bleeding. I think you mean bleeding edge, I think. Although I am gently falling back. I'm still sticking with late 2022 for RPKs led by the U.S. The headline of the post in your mailbox in my driveway is the U.S. set to drive global growth. And nowhere is that more true than with RPKs. I have not flown since March 9th, and I'm scheduling lots of flights coming up. It's coming back. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I am shocked by what's going on in the EU. I didn't see that one coming. All of a sudden, colleagues of mine in Britain who had amazingly been pro-Brexit are actually starting to make valid points. didn't see that one coming either. Really didn't. Nevertheless, I still think, look, this is going to be a happy story by the end of the year, and we're going to get back there. About wide bodies, that doesn't happen. It does not get back in the 10-year time horizon. We're looking at an acceleration of pre-existing conditions across the board in terms of jetliner markets, and that is especially true with the shift away from twin aisles and towards single aisles. And with that, the build down of massive overcapacity in twin aisles. So, what's going to happen is you're just going to see a strong comeback in single aisles. That's just not going to be matched. A lot of that comeback is going to be bought and paid for at the expense of twin aisle programs. And I think the industry needs to start dealing with that. As for Sasha's point about Boeing pulling ahead, it's just a month. I think the real problem is still for Airbus getting production issues sorted out with the 321, which is arguably their most relevant program by a wide margin and a place that they'd been falling behind. We'll see. I tend to think still structurally, Airbus has a bit of an advantage and Boeing needs to do something about that. So I'm reluctant to give Boeing any kind of props for a one-month pull ahead.
Ron, your sense on all of this?
Yeah, I'm pretty much lined up with Richard in that, if you look at the timing of order activity this year, sure, there's going to be some catch-up orders on 737s. I mean, we've seen that already. You do have to scratch your head on, there's things like, so for example, Southwest orders, quote unquote, in the headlines, right? They order 100 737-7 MAXs, but 70 of those were actually 8 MAXs that got transferred to 7 MAXs. And you have to wonder around the pricing and that sort of stuff on it. But I wouldn't be surprised this year if you see Boeing do better in the narrow body market than Airbus just because of the catch-up stuff. But ultimately, it comes down to deliveries and the ability to ramp. One of the things we haven't talked about, and this impacts both suppliers, is the ability of the supply chain to ramp, right? Because they're going to be suffering from some of the same issues that we're seeing in other industries in terms of shortages, labor, that kind of stuff, so on and so forth. So we'll see how it all goes. In the wide body market, we're not looking for a recovery there until the mid 2020s, and there's no reason to to think otherwise, right? I mean, just to remind everybody, the wide body market was already in a decline before the pandemic, right? Right. We'd seen that, you know, in 777 and in the lease rates and A330 in the lease rates, and for sure, I mean, that was crystal clear for the better part of 18 months to 2 years. And that just got, you know, slammed in the downturn. And we even saw a weakening, if you remember, in 787. 787 order activity was weakening before this. So, yeah, the outlook for the wide body market, you know, at this point looks, you know pretty punky, for lack of better words. Where narrow bodies seem like they should do okay, right, ultimately. But Sasha's point, I mean, there's a lot of capacity sloshing around the world. And unlike real estate, airplanes, you can just move them around, right? So, I mean, some of that demand, I think, will be relieved by just moving some assets around the world.
Shifting gears a little bit on U.S.-China trade tensions, the Biden administration has managed to bring Canada, the United Kingdom, the EU, and a number of other nations together in terms of pressuring China. We discussed how that's actually a factor in the dramatic degrading of the deal, the recent deal between Brussels and Beijing. And now we're hearing from Dave Calhoun, the Boeing chief executive, admonishing or urging the U.S. government to try to separate human rights from trade. Obviously, if I was a company and a third of my 737 MAXs are supposed to go to China, I'd be very, very sensitized on Beijing punishing Boeing or U.S. Suppliers. There's a concern that this could also be impacting Airbus at the end of the day as well, although Sash, you're on the record saying there's an assembly plant there, so that should minimize some of the implications. But how do we need to think about where we are and where we go? Because I think that the Biden administration's attitude towards this is, listen, it's either pay now or pay later. If you don't enforce red lines with Beijing, you're going to get yourself in a war that's going to be much more expensive at the end of the day than any trade impact on industry. How, you know, Ron, let's start with you and then move across to everybody, right? How's this going to play out and what are the implications? Because at the end of the day, it's not abundantly clear to me that Boeing is going to, you know, that the U.S. government's going to be like, okay, you know, Boeing's going to take a $10 billion hit here. Let's not do what we need to do when the broader stakes are actually remarkably higher at the end of the day, right? From a deterrence, competition, war standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, to steal a phrase from Brother Richard, you know, commercial aircraft programs end up being hostages in these situations. And you know, that's, I think, in a nutshell, what's going on here. I mean, honestly, it's above my pay grade to tell you that, you know, somehow me and Boeing can get through this unharmed if we've got, you know, a broader, more hawkish stance with respect to China on multiple fronts, on the humanitarian front, on the technology front, and so on and so forth. Right? I mean, it's not lost on me, and we've talked about this before on this podcast, that right now you've got, you know, Taiwan Semi building, like tripling down on the facilities that they say they're going to build in the U.S. And that's in no small reason unrelated to the fact that they're sitting there right across the street from the mainland, right? I mean, that's part of it. And then you've got, you know, Foxconn talking about building something here. So the point is, there's a broader backdrop of, you know, technology competition still going on with the humanitarian thing. And, it, you know, and as we've discussed before, you know, the current administration has gone, multilateral from a national point of view, not unilateral. So if you've got a group of allies and you're going to take this bigger stance, you know, where Boeing comes out of this, it's hard to say, but it's hard not to imagine that at a minimum, the 737 program, at least for a while, it isn't held hostage in all this.
And right, we should point out Beijing has yet to recertify the airplane, even though everybody else in the world at this point has recertified. Sash?
I mean, I think that Mr. Calhoun's comments were all fair, you know, the morality of saying just put human rights to one side and let us keep on trading is not a good look. I'll leave it at that. But I think also this was just a very ill-judged statement because he was making it to the wrong people. It's not the US that is deciding to put human rights ahead of or you know, human rights and everything else, intellectual property, ahead of trade. It's China that is using this as the key lever that it has against the US administration, and then, you know, to all other administrations, whether it's Australia or the EU, that join with the US in those particular causes. And if they decide to do it, it's going to happen. And I'm afraid Boeing's position in that will be roadkill. They'll be the first. There'll be plenty more. Airbus will eventually suffer. But if the Chinese need capacity, and frankly, we don't think they do, because it's very apparent that the Chinese airlines, having bought back a lot of capacity in the last 6 months, are discovering that most of it is flying empty and with shockingly low yield. So, you know, they could manage to have a procurement holiday for a couple of years easily. But if they need capacity, you know, they'll take from Airbus as their least worst option. But, you know, Boeing is going to be the one that suffers first. You know, no matter what Boeing says to the US government, other than the US government just deciding to stand down altogether and say to the Chinese, you want Taiwan, you can have Taiwan. Uyghurs, we don't, you know, we're not too fussed about them. And that's, you'd be better judges than me of whether that would happen. But it seems to me that's pretty unlikely. But, you know, other than that happening, it's the Chinese that have made the decision to make aircraft a political issue, and they'll do that.
I should point out that as this is playing out and Calhoun was making those statements, China is asserting itself again in a contested reef, this time the Julian Felipe Reef in the Philippines, where it's lashed together a number of, they're not fishing boats, right? They're government fishing militia, I think, ships seeking shelter from some future storm, which isn't really how mariners really do things at the end of the day. And this is sort of seen as another provocation where Beijing is trying to grab another contested piece of real estate to then build a military installation on it. And so all eyes are on whether Washington is going to be somewhat more vocal in responding than the Obama administration, which had a tendency of being remarkably quiet as this was going on, as you know, without necessarily as you know, strong statements as might may have been necessary. Richard, your take?
Yeah, strong agreement. You know, Dave Calhoun's comments came across as somebody who just had a conversation with the chief executive of H&M at the golf course or something, and seemed a bit clueless about the reality. Nothing to do with human rights. I mean, yes, they're a great concern to a lot of people, but those are the sort of things you address in consumer to consumer goods, or, you know, business to business. It doesn't have anything to do with aerospace. Aerospace is about geopolitics. And right now, just exactly per that point you just made about the, well, the so-called fishing fleet, the South China Sea, the issue is geopolitics. It's Taiwan. It's about the Canadians being held hostage under the fabric of some illegal trial. It's about their confrontation with Australia. And yes, it's about the Biden administration joining with allies and hitting back against this. Nothing at all to do with Xinjiang or Hong Kong. And, you know, so Calhoun's comments, I think, are just nothing to do with reality. We're, you know, we're dealing with a serious geopolitical confrontation. And yes, back to Brother Ron, it's we're the designated hostage. I will immediately take a moment to once again say that despite CAAC's marvelous attempts at keeping China safe in terms of the overall aviation safety ecosystem there, once again, they've shown themselves to be mere pawns and not at all reliable in the game of being a serious government safety organization. They're simply a political pawn. Have a nice day. The other thing I'd point out is that not only, per Sasha's comments, not only can they take a procurement holiday given the plateauing out of Chinese air travel demand, which had been a factor in the market even before the pandemic, 2019 saw some decades, numbers we hadn't seen in decades in terms of slowing rates. Not only that, but they'd kind of be talking their book because they hold the notes on an awful lot of jetliners. And of course, if you you know, reduce the number of new planes being taken in by the market, you're effectively increasing the value of stuff on your existing portfolio. So, yeah, I don't think it's in their interest at all to get back to ordering jets anytime soon.
Look, I mean, if you're going to be disingenuous about taking over, you know, a contested reef, in this case, Whitsun Reef. You know, I mean, really, are you going to play it square when it comes to the certification of airplanes, right? I mean, China has gotten to where it's gotten to by being an integrated commercial military power, where everything is a national security issue. And honestly, in that sense, they're taking kind of a cue from the United States during the Cold War, where everything we did was integrated, right? I mean, Americans have a tendency of forgetting the national highway system was a military investment that the United States was making, just like the airportification of the United States also had sort of strategic military interests, right? I mean, we wanted people to become private pilots because flying was a skill in case we need to surge. You know, we have a ready reservoir of airmen, for example. Let me shift gears to get Sash your take on the deal between Airbus and Dassault. This is sort of classical negotiating over the SCAF program, right? Dassault makes provocative comments, says, you know, if we don't get a deal, you know, this is really, you know, working with Airbus is a nightmare. Ultimately, we've got to be in charge. If we don't get a deal, we're walking away and we've got a plan B. And then all of a sudden, there are news reports that Airbus and Dassault may be close to an agreement. Talk to us a little bit about the slow dancing here and what it means.
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that any of our long-suffering regular listeners will realize. We've touched on this pretty much every other week for the last 6 months now. The SCAF program is probably the biggest continental European combat aircraft program of the next many decades, and it's incredibly important for the Franco-German-Spanish relationship. The problem, I think, is that Dassault Aviation wants and intends to lead the design of the fighter, the air vehicle, but German politicians have had enough of playing second fiddle, whether it's to the British or to the French, and want to have equality. And in this case, the Airbus we're talking about is Airbus Defence and Space, which is the German-headquartered defence business within Airbus. It is not Airbus Commercial Aircraft, which is clearly has its heart in Toulouse. So this is a Franco-German spat. And Reuters are reporting that following some very, very punchy comments by Dassault's chief executive, Eric Trappier, the other week, and you're absolutely right, he said, you know, there's always a plan B, where plan B was widely held to be a Franco-French program and to hell with everybody else. Following that, and then some extremely interesting inquiries by the French Parliament, there seems to have been a sort of coming together. I think what's going to be interesting is to see the degree to which any agreement between Dassault and Airbus Defence Space actually meets the expectations of the German Parliament. German Parliament has become incredibly focused, I would say, to the point of micromanagement in defense and aerospace issues. And, you know, that's a good thing. That's actually about being a sovereign nation. But it's not something that any of its partners have got a great deal of experience of. And I don't actually think the German Parliament has got a great deal of experience in doing this well and doing this in a collaborative way. So it's good news if there is an agreement. I think what's positive about it is that both Trappier and Dirk Hoecker, the head of Airbus Defence and Space, are ultimately highly intelligent, very rational people. So they are able to work out what really matters. Can they deliver their respective parliaments? That's the big question. And then the question for Dirk Hoecker is, can he deliver the Bundestag and the Bundestag's agreement before the summer recess in mid-July and before the German elections? And that's actually a horribly tight deadline to get this done by, because without that, there's nothing done then until sometime in Q4.
Richard, you'd somebody who has always said that this is a long road to nowhere, that this project is unlikely to be realized. You wrote that now 3.5 years ago, if memory serves correctly, and we've discussed it here. Anything you see on this that changes your estimate?
You know, not at all. from my standpoint, this is merely the tip of an iceberg that just doesn't work. You know, I mean, it's one thing to get the airframers aligned. That's just the, you know, those are just the prime contractors. Wait till it comes down to the engine, the radar, the EW system. I can't wait to see those negotiations when Safran says, oh, yes, MTU, and here is your 5% share. And, you know, you'll have Thales say, ah, EW and radar, Hensoldt, here's your 5% share. It just doesn't work that way. With everything that has ever taken place in France. It's not just that that's plan B, it is that his historic reality ever since World War II. Everything is a joint venture between French industry and French industry with no examples of major risk sharing. And I'm taken back to 1983 when the negotiations took place between Eurofighter and Rafale, or the people who would later absorb those projects, and France said, five nation project, great idea, we want 46%. That reflected reality. And of course, that's how the Rafale happened, a Franco-French project. Exactly the same thing will happen this time. And one small agreement, which has nothing to do with the broader geopolitical problems or the subcontractor problems or any other problems, but just between two people who want this to work, it means exactly nothing.
Sash, I know you want to go back to an earlier point, so take it away.
Yeah, it's just the point about if what, as an old Cold Warrior, I think we would recognize to be flashpoints for the Chinese at the moment, things that wind the Chinese up in a geopolitical sense, and that are, from the point of view of trade, probably pretty unhelpful. And the only point that I think Richard raised that was not, and you raised that was not cut, that was not actually covered, was that the British are taking a multinational carrier strike group through the South China Seas in about 2 months' time. It's a classic freedom of navigation operation, but frankly, it's also, you know, part of Boris Johnson's global Britain stuff. And it's a chance to show that, you know, we've got an aircraft carrier and this is a very multinational task force by the standards of such operations. There's a Netherlands air defense frigate there. There's a US Arleigh Burke class frigate there as well, and all sorts of other stuff. But I can't help feeling that the timing of that, given the issues with the reef off the Philippines and so forth, it's looking more provocative now than I think it was intended to be when the whole CSG-21 deployment was first mooted a year and a half ago.
Well, right. I mean, it was a different universe where the rhetoric was tougher, sadly, than the reality was. Now the reality is catching up and folks are wondering what exactly that means, whether you're Dave Calhoun or even maybe people in Beijing who at this point were like, hey, wait a minute, these guys should have backed down by now, instead of doing all of this stuff that gets under our skin. And if you look at how the administration is thinking about this and you know the character of the people who are involved, I think their attitude very much is going to be that, you know, with the Chinese, you've got to be tough. Otherwise, it begets further problems. I should point out that everybody is very happy that Queen Elizabeth is doing this deployment, but it is also in part a multinational deployment, in part because of national limitations, right? I mean, there are Marine Corps F-35s aboard the ships because the UK does not yet have its full complement of aircraft to allow in order to do that. Although from an exercising standpoint, it is something that shows the power of a multinational deployment and certainly advantageous for all the nations involved.
But also, Vargo, clearly what that means is it drags in a whole lot more nations than just the UK.
Absolutely so. And I've sort of been saying this to Europeans for a long time. You guys, you know, think of a war with China as an impossibility from a European perspective, failing to recognize that the United States is part of NATO. And in the event that the Chinese shoot at the Japanese, the United States is at war against China. And it's only a matter of time before Article 5 is invoked. And a whole bunch of people in Europe who never expected to be sailing in the South China Sea are going to be calling the UK government up for some of the world's best maritime charts of the Pacific, right? So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's you know, everything is interlinked. So, I think it's a very, very valuable and very vital point you're making. Richard, one last point. I know that you want to do a bit of airing of SPAC grievances, special purpose acquisition companies.
SPACs don't irritate me in and of themselves. Matter of fact, I think they can do a lot of good in providing capital for the, you know, traditional aerospace supply chain and aerospace companies that have interesting ideas for new products. What concerns me is the concentration of SPAC money with urban air mobility, which is zero revenues, uncertain technologies, uncertain market, and attracting gobs of cash. If SPACs were going after traditional aerospace suppliers, I'd be quite happy. I really would. What worries me is you've got, $11 billion going into just two companies, Joby and Archer William, about to follow with billions more. And do we know that this will come to anything? No, we don't. And of course, there are another 200 and something UAM wannabes also looking for a SPAC attack like these. So the very specter of all this cash going into something that may or may not produce results, that if it doesn't produce results, what does it do from investor sentiment to our industry? I'll let my colleagues opine on that, but I'm a little concerned.
I think it's great. It's a new area of technology. It's something that's potentially game changing, and a lot of money will go into it. And some people will make a lot of money, and other people will lose money. The way it
well,
goes.
If I could just add to that, you know, we lived through very light jets and air taxis back 15 years ago. I wrote about that in real time at the time, and the thing that still shocks me is that there's nothing to show for it. I would have thought Eclipse, after like the third bankruptcy, would be worth something to somebody, but no, it's just gone, period. Similarly, you know, operations like Dayjets, there's Stats Air, any of these folks, or the other dozens of, you know, very light jet wannabe producers, all of it came to exactly nothing. It was like watching grains of sand run through your fingers.
Absolutely. But it's all about timing and the state of the technological art when it comes to autonomy, control, communications, sensing. We're in a very different ballgame when it comes to all of it, right? And it's not just a one-off where Aurora was working on something really, really interesting and quirky. You've got a lot of big companies, or I just say full disclosure, Bell, who sponsors our podcast, is obviously involved in the space, as are hundreds and hundreds of other companies. Ron, bring it home, if you will.
Yeah, so I think you have to look at it a couple different ways. And, you know, I'm, you know, clearly, you know, sensitive to, you know, what Richard's saying. However, what's, I think, different with the SPACs is it's allowing a public equity investor to take a position in a company at an early stage where they normally wouldn't be able to. And as long as they understand the risks they're taking, you know, I'm comfortable with it. But they just have to fully understand these are early stage companies. Some will make it, some won't. And you get an opportunity to invest where typically private equity or venture capital would, and you can do it as a public equity investor. And then I would say on urban air mobility, that's one application of the electrification of aircraft. And I think you have to look at the electrification of aircraft as a interesting potential new technology. And ultimately, right, airframes are designed around propulsion systems. And if we can get electric propulsion systems to work, either through battery or hydrogen or you name it, that could create some interesting design opportunities that wouldn't otherwise exist. And an application of that is urban air mobility, and we'll see if that plays out. But for me, the more exciting piece is the maybe coming of age of electric propulsion in aircraft, at least for some small set of applications around more regional trips, either be it in fixed wing or some sort of, you know, rotorcraft. So it's that's what excites me.
I think it's a very, very exciting space. In 15 seconds, Richard, do you have anything you want to add? And then Sash, I'll give you another 10 seconds as well to finish up. Go ahead.
I want to believe. But yeah, I mean, there's potential for electrification to rejuvenate existing market segments, but creating something all new or creating something that is expected to grow thousands of percent relative to where it is now, that is something that technology just can't do for you. So I that's my big concern.
Now, the thing that worries me about urban air mobility or eVTOL is that actually, I mean, Ron hit the nail on the head. It's about the electrification of flight, which is a technology shift that aviation needs, and this is probably the right place to do it. But the problem is that what is also required for eVTOL to work is something totally different, which is autonomous flight at incredibly low altitudes and incredibly high densities. And to have a sector or a subsector that's trying to do two astonishingly difficult things at the same time, and where investors think they're buying one thing when actually the challenge is somewhere else, that I don't think has been adequately addressed by any of the companies. And if you look at electric cars work very, very well. But the companies that have plowed billions into autonomous driving, you know, the Teslas, the Waymos, Waymo, Google of this world, have failed so far. But eVTOL will not work if there is a pilot at the in the cockpit doing this, because private pilots, even professional taxi driver pilots, whatever we want to call them, are the most dangerous things in the sky. Period. That's how people die, is private pilots flying small little things. So there has to be autonomous flight, but all of the SPACs are focusing on fiberglass, carbon fiber things with lots of rotating egg beaters, and they're not focusing on the air traffic management side of it that is utterly essential for the autonomous flight, which makes this safe in the first place. My two cents.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Absolute pleasure having you on. As always, have a great week, and looking forward to having you back on again next Sunday when we get back to regular order. Thanks very much again. All the best.
Thanks, Vago. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Vago.
Really a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.